The following Dharma talk was given by Katie Yosha Scott Childress. Yosha is a senior student in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or to find out more about our various programs, visit us online at cmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Good afternoon. My name is Yosha. My teacher, Shugen Roshi, asked me to offer a talk today, and I wanted to talk about Ango, my experience, and just bring us into these last hours of this 90 days that we've all been practicing together, practicing well. So how are we going to use these last few hours that we have left? Ango means peaceful dwelling. So what is a peaceful dwelling? What's peaceful abiding? Where is the peaceful dwelling? Is the peaceful dwelling created, or is it already something that's existent that we discover or uncover? Does it vanish at the end of Ango, or does it persist? So we've been studying the paramitas with Shantideva's Way of the Bodhisattva. And he says, those who wish to crush the many sorrows of existence, who wish to of living beings, who wish to have experience of myriad joys, should never turn away from bodhicitta. Drawing this box around our 90-day training period or any increment of time allows us to intentionally apply our effort to practice. And this practice, this bodhicitta practice, is really going another way. It's like standing in a river that's flowing in one direction and walking upstream. It's not easy. And our habits are the river that's flowing in this direction that we're usually getting washed away with. So how we're responding to the world is our practice of bodhicitta. Dogen said, it is not without cause that mind and things, self and other, come together. Therefore, at the moment you arouse the aspiration for enlightenment, myriad things become the conditions that increase this aspiration. So we are arising out of conditions, moment after moment. And in the Yogacara teachings, there's this metaphor of our underlying consciousness being this storehouse that's filled with seeds. And the seeds come from our individual and our collective karma. And so our practice is to be aware of what's coming up right now. How am I reacting to the environment, to people, to things that are going on? And then what seeds am I planting right now that are going to continue and condition the next moment? We're like this sort of rolling bundle of causes and conditions, seeds, changing all the time. So when Dogen says it's not without cause that mind and things, self and other, come together, he's talking about these conditions that bring us into this moment. Everything, our birth, what we eat, our good fortune, messed up things that have happened to us, choices we've made, habits we've formed, everything, all of it is bringing us into this right now. Nothing is left out. And with it comes this sense of me. This is me. This is happening to me. Dogen's saying that the moment we arouse the aspiration for enlightenment, which means the aspiration to liberate ourselves and others from afflicted states of greed, anger, and ignorance, and then the myriad conditions that spin out from those. He's saying that we change the world by changing our orientation to the world, like walking upstream in a river. We're arising out of these conditions, and we're creating conditions all the time. So our habitual way is to get away from what we don't like and get more of whatever we do, that whatever makes us feel good. And our practice is to work with our reactions to what's actually coming up all the time. One of Shantideva's, I think, most quoted parts of the Way of the Bodhisattva sums up our sort of self-centered orientation so well. It says, all the joys the world contains has come through wishing happiness for others. All the misery the world contains has come through wanting pleasure for oneself. And this really runs against the messages that we've gotten, I think, as a culture, you know, as an American culture, of get ahead, succeed, get a lot of shiny things, get what you want, and then you'll be happy, right? But this has also been going on since Shantideva's time, and even the Buddha taught about the eight worldly winds, these eight conditions that sort of blow us around, wanting fame and wanting to get away from disrepute, wanting praise and wanting to always deflect blame, wanting pleasure and to get away from pain. So some of that's natural, right? We don't want to like put our hand into a fire. But there's so many seeds in this consciousness that we have that have been planted over endless generations of wanting what's good for me and not caring so much about what's good for you. And so this bodhicitta is turning this around, even though We know that giving feels good. And we know that we're connected. We're totally interconnected because we are. And we know it at some level. And yet we have a whole river that we're part of and born into that flows in a direction of not taking care. And so we're turning around and saying all the good that the world contains is from me wanting good for others, not for myself. We're taught to just want totally unreasonable things. We keep seeing the advertisements and keep buying in, thinking that maybe we're going to gain this thing that's going to make us happy. And it's about my happiness, right? It's not about really totally being oriented toward the happiness of others. So it's a radical practice, raising bodhicitta. It's radical. It's turning against a lot of habits, a lot of inclinations. And even though we have this tendency towards endless desires, we know at some level that it's not right. And that's what brings us here, keeps us sitting here, facing what's difficult to face over and over again. We're meeting this. So we need a peaceful dwelling right now more than ever, as our country feels like it's unraveling. And we create these conditions for a peaceful dwelling by practicing the paramitas. At the most basic level, practicing good for others, manifesting good for others, ceasing from evil. And we're doing that like all day here in Sesshin. It's crazy, but we're just sitting here and we're seeing evil arise in our mind and we're meeting it, right? And we're not acting, and hopefully we're not getting too carried away. And if we do get carried away, we remember at some point and we come back to our practice and we see the way that our minds go and go and go. And so we are practicing creating this peaceful dwelling by meeting what's coming up all the time, meeting our craving, meeting our aversion, meeting our ignorance. So we don't meet it, we just get blown around by it or swept away like a strong river. Shanti Deva says, now when a building is ablaze and flames leap out from house to house, the wise course is to take and fling away the straw and anything that spreads the fire. So how do we remove the tinder that keeps this fire going? I've turned off news notifications on my phone because that gets the fire going for me, running around after headlines. And I do read the news, but I make a choice that I'm going to do that. And I also know that it affects me really deeply. And so, you know, I am going to know that I will be terrorized by a lot of what I read and be depressed. So I need to make space for that and know that I'm doing it, right? Rather than just letting the headlines keep coming and coming, and again, letting this fire burn or getting swept down this river, feeling out of control. And, you know, there's so many of these things that we're in the midst of that we may not have the agency to change. And so I need to also recognize that I can make myself more and more miserable by reading things that are upsetting and have no agency. So what is my agency? That's what I'm asking myself. There's a lot of people who think there might be a civil war. But I have to look at myself and say, am I taking sides against people in my country? And if I am, where does that civil war reside? I I have to meet fear that's coming up in me. Because if I act out of that, I'm just creating more of what's already happening. You know, powerful people like Elon Musk, he's afraid. He has fear. He's afraid that fossil fuels are going to run out, so he invests in an electric car company. And he's afraid of the Earth becoming uninhabitable, so he's invested in a rocket ship company. And he's afraid of population decline, so he has 11 children so far. He wants more. He's afraid. And if I meet his fear with my fear, what world are we creating? So when I fantasize about moving to another country, because I do go there a little bit, you know, that's not the way of the Bodhisattva. The way of the Bodhisattva is to turn toward what's going on, turn toward the source of what's going on. Meet it with tenderness, meet it with an open heart. Bodhisattva is large and can hold this. These afflictive states. How do we liberate others if we can't meet our own afflicted states? We have to meet this. So sitting here, you know, in session, hours of meditation, I can see how self-centered I am and start feeling like a really shitty person. And, you know, Shantideva throughout the way of the Bodhisattva is confessing to what a shitty person he is in so many ways, that he's lazy and self-centered and indulgent and fantasizing and all of this, right? Over and over again. And he keeps saying, just turn back. Turn to bodhicitta. Keep turning back to bodhicitta. Keep arousing and clarifying this aspiration. What is your aspiration? What is it? It's got to be so deeply felt and understood by each of us personally in order to really be who we are, in order to really guide how we meet our lives, how we meet our minds. Otherwise, we just have afflictive states giving rise to more afflictive states. Exhibit A, our country, right now. So there are really actually no shitty people, even though it feels that way. There are afflictive states giving rise to more afflictive states. So for me, it's important to have compassion for even people who are taking leadership in this country right now, because their actions are arising out of afflictive states. And my actions arise out of ignorance as well. And I can see that. I don't want to meet that with more fear and ignorance. I want to meet it with openness of some kind. I have this inmate that I've been corresponding with for like 8 years, and he's been in segregation for many years, And I've been worried about his mental health. But recently I got a letter from him and he's doing really well. And one thing he talked about was that he had these pet spiders. And, you know, he was feeding them cockroaches and observing them really carefully. And then when he was exercising, he was really so amazed by the spiders, watching them molt and how they moved out of their old body and, you know, not into their new body. They already were their new body, but they moved out of this old body. And it's like it sort of penetrated into his psyche really deeply, and it affects him. He can't stop thinking about it, like when he's exercising and this sort of movement, this locking and pushing movement he does when he's exercising. He's thinking of himself as the spider molting, right? But he said, you know, I realized that these spiders and roaches and rats weren't going anywhere, and neither am I. And so I might as well befriend them. You know, I think there's at some level we want like disagreeable people and people we disagree with to go away. But they're not going away, and neither am I. So how do we make friends with what's disagreeable? Everything that's happening right now is happening for a reason, right? Because of previous conditions. So it makes sense, even though it may not be what I want it to happen. There is this Chinese parable about this farmer whose horse runs away, and the neighbor says, "Oh, that's terrible." He says, "Maybe." And, you know, then the horse comes back with two wild horses, and neighbor's like, "That's great." And the farmer says, "Maybe." And then the farmer's son gets on the wild horse and gets thrown off and breaks his leg. And the neighbor says, "That's terrible." And farmer says, "Maybe." And then the draft comes and the army wants to recruit him, but he's got a broken leg. And the neighbor says, "That's great." The guy says, "Maybe." So we have this kind of like hubris about knowing, like, I know how this is all going to turn out, and it's really, really bad, right? Maybe. I don't know, actually. There's a lot of our practice in Zen that's about not knowing. It takes a kind of tenderness to not know. It takes vulnerability, right? Knowing is this hubris of thinking, it's a sort of arrogance of thinking that we know. Arrogance and elitism are some of the qualities that have been associated with Democrats. My sister has been saying, how do we throw away our red and blue glasses? What stories are we telling ourselves that make us feel separate from people? Half the country, right? I want this country to be great again. Yes. But I'm not well informed, actually. I'm lost in a stew of ignorance and desires and aversion. I need to own that. I don't know how to get there, actually. It's So I think that these teachings aren't saying, like, sit on the sidelines and just be like, I don't know, whatever. It's not that. It's saying, I don't know. I'm going to step forward and still not know and keep stepping forward because I don't know. I think it's important for me in these, like, political times to remember that as a Buddhist, I'm studying the source of suffering, which is our mind. So if I don't see how I act out of my karma, then I can't change the bigger karma that's going on around me. Vasubandhu said, apart from the discernment of dharmas, there's no means to extinguish the afflictions. And it is by reason of the afflictions that the world wanders in the ocean of existence. So if we want the world to change, we can stand outside with signs and bullhorns yelling, we want change. And sometimes that's effective, but working to actually gain a seat at the table is a different kind of effort, and it requires a lot of work and a lot of compromise. So my husband's on the city council in Kingston, and he is out at meetings most weeknights, sitting around with other members of the community in various committees, hashing out decisions about various things, from where to put a stop sign to which trees to take down to making a sanctuary city, all kinds of things. And it's incredibly time-consuming. It's slow. It's deliberative. There's disagreeable people and people you disagree with who you have to spend a lot of time with. And that's what it actually means to be in a democracy, is participating, showing up. How many of us are really willing to put our lives into this endeavor we call a democracy? I'm not actually, I mean, I have to own the fact that I don't put in as much of my time and my energy as I would like to, or that I think would make a difference. So I can't really be pointing fingers right now when I say things are falling apart, right? So we get a different perspective, I think, when we get in closer to anything. There's all these problems that are going on right now. It's like, can be so freaked out. But all of these systems are really complicated. There's a lot of moving parts, a lot of people. And so the sort of fear and anxiety comes from being on the outside and looking in and not understanding. Stepping forward, helping, trying to actually be involved in making change, it's a completely different experience, right, than standing outside and wringing our hands, yelling at people. And he gets yelled at a lot, unfortunately, my husband does. And it's often by people who are on the far left, who don't understand the issues well enough, and they just want to yell at somebody. painful. So we have to really look at, where is our agency in changing the world? What are we doing? What do we want to do? What are we willing to do? Complaining's not really an issue, an option right now. The day after the election, I was kind of moping around in this like grief and disbelief. And my husband's like, in 2 years, there's always a backlash against the party in power. Like, we need to get to work now. You know, like, there's no time to sit and have a pity party. Get to work now. So it's hard. It's hard to change. It's hard to change the world. It's hard to change myself. I had an opportunity to try and make some change. In October, I had a program at my library that came out of a patron bringing some books to me that he found offensive because he did not like the way that white people were portrayed in these children's picture books. And the one book he was really reacting to was called The Talk. And it was a picture book about how a little African-American boy who is having a beautiful childhood and happy-go-lucky, his parents had to sit down and have the talk with him about why he wasn't safe around police and why he needed to take care. And this guy was really undone by this. He was so offended and didn't feel that this was appropriate for children. And so I knew this guy because he had been to other reading and discussion groups that we had at the library where I work. So I asked him, would you be willing to be in some kind of discussion group about this? And he said yes. And so in October, I convened this group and had a professor of Black Studies and a professor of Peace Studies facilitating it, and we drew this really nice multiracial group of people who came, and you know, especially the African American people in the group talked about why they had to give their children the talk and the experiences that they had had at the hands of police and other racist people. And this guy, he really doubled down on his point of view that this was not appropriate for children, that this was just so negative and so divisive. And it was an amazing experience because the group, the facilitators and the group itself were very compassionate, and people were very open and kind, and yet he really couldn't let it go, you know? And at some point, I just was thinking like, wow, like, we're all here just for you, you know? This whole group of people, the topic of the group was banned children's books, picture books. And I chose like a dozen children's picture books that were banned on the basis of racial content. And it's just absurd. I mean, they're really just banned because they represent Black experience, basically. And we all agreed that book banning's not okay. But this guy, his hurt, he couldn't let it go. And he never divulged to this group that he's a corrections officer. So something's going on with his karma of keeping people locked up, where he doesn't want to be racist. I know he checks out lots of books about race. I know he's very interested in this issue. And yet, he wasn't able to, at least in through this two-part discussion, he wasn't able to shift. He doubled down. So just thinking about like how hard it is to change somebody's mind, even when they're kind of like open to it, it's really hard. And even changing my own habits of mind, even when I'm like, I am so sick of this storyline, I see it coming up over and over again, and yet there it is, right? It's hard to change. It's hard. So it's, Hogan Sensei has said a number of times, we need to respect people's karma. Respect how we don't know all of the conditions that have created that person that is sitting there before us, or that half of the country that we don't know. We barely even understand our own karma and what keeps rolling along unskillful habits that we want to shift, and yet they don't shift just because we want them to shift. We have to keep working at it, right? It's astounding, and it's humbling to see how hard it is to shift people's minds, shift our own minds. I think if we're really paying attention to what's going on, we can see that. So Shanti Deva says, with perfect and unyielding faith, with steadfastness, respect, and courtesy, with conscientiousness and awe, work calmly for the happiness of others. So for me, creating this peaceful dwelling means putting myself in the practice place, coming here, coming to the monastery, carving out time to sit at home, studying, reflecting on the teachings, practicing art, practicing giving, practicing taking care of my body, practicing the precepts, atoning when I make mistakes, clarifying my aspiration, noticing when I'm being harsh with myself, noticing when I'm being harsh with others. Just remembering to do this. Even when I backslide, I feel like I'm held by this aspiration, this bodhicitta, these vows, vow to wake up, vow to help others. All of these practices spring from this. And so it's worth coming back to over and over again. What is it? How does it live in you, in me? How is it operating? We're learning to concentrate. Concentration's like this muscle that we have to strengthen over and over again. So, keep turning back over and over again. Keep asking, what am I taking up right now? What's sweeping me away? How do I turn back to what I know is important? This is a tenderizing practice. Keep finding the places where our heart can open. This is where I can meet the afflicted states that are arising in me. This is where the peaceful dwelling happens. And this peaceful dwelling conditions the next moment. How big is our peaceful dwelling? Who does it include? Let's make it as large as possible.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.